You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest on today's podcast is Stephanie Harrison, who is an expert in the science of happiness and a writer, designer, and speaker. Her company, The New Happy, has revolutionized the way that people understand and pursue happiness. She's got a new book. It's called The New Happy, Getting Happiness Right in a World That's Got It Wrong. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Stephanie Harrison, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be with you.
I am very happy to be with you. In the introduction of your book, it's called My Story, and it begins in 2013. Can you tell us about that time in your life?
Yeah, so let me set the scene. I'm lying on my bedroom floor, sobbing my eyes out, absolutely miserable, wondering, why am I not happy? Because I did everything I was supposed to do. I achieved all the things that I thought would make me happy. And yet I felt completely lonely, miserable, frustrated, full of self-hatred, struggling with physical illnesses and mental challenges. And it was at that moment that I realized that maybe I was doing everything all wrong and I should revisit that instead of blaming myself for the millionth time.
How old were you then?
22.
You're a young person.
I was young.
Yeah, yeah. All right. We do know each other.
Yes.
So, when your publicist reached out though, I didn't put two and two together. I don't know. I'm trying to even recall how that went back and forth. I think I might've said, yes, let's book her. And then the publicist is like, oh, she knows you.
Yeah. Cause she sent me an email and she goes, oh, I've just booked you with Kelly. And I was like, I know Kelly. I'm so excited. And it was a moment of real joy for me.
All right. Do you want to, I'm curious, why don't you explain to our audience how we know each other?
So right before I left my full-time job to work on my company and my work, which is at The New Happy, we crossed paths when I was working at Thrive, where I was responsible for leading the development of all of the educational and training programs. And you were responsible for leading it at Second City. And we were exploring partnerships and working together. So we had all these meetings to figure out how we could collaborate. And we got to partner together and talk about all those ideas.
Yeah, I recall many a nerdy conversation where we had this like a very, you know, a slightly unhealthy interest in the science of all the things.
Exactly. Let's just nerd out over all of the learning science and how to motivate people. It was great. Kindred spirits.
And I should say that, you know, the partnership didn't go ahead, but there were reasons for that because this was March of 2020.
Yeah.
And my last event I did was a live webinar taping with Arianna Huffington in the Thrive offices.
It's a good way to end that
it's
era.
A good way to end that. Like, yeah,
move on to whatever
so
we're in now.
Bizarre. I really loved your book. And you say early in the book that, quote, happiness is a fuzzy, vague concept, end quote. When you started sort of this me search around happiness, you had to find some definitions for it, right? That's part of this journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had to figure out what was wrong with my understanding and my definition of happiness. And I first turned toward the scientific literature to see what they said. But to be honest, I didn't find it that useful because a lot of scientists have they're sometimes just disconnected from how it feels to a person in a way. And I get why we have to do that in order to be able to study it. But for example, like one of the core definitions of happiness in the literature is subjective well-being, which is a combination of how you feel versus how you evaluate your life to be going. And that's great. It's really helpful for being able to run analyses and surveys and get a pulse for people. But it turned out what I was looking for was not a definition of what happiness is, but the pathway to be able to get to it and to experience it as well, like the how behind happiness. And so ultimately, that's what led me to do all this work to try and figure it out for myself.
So one of the things that you talk about again early in the book, which is something that I think I came to after you, but is it resonates with me because I was born in 66 and I'm the youngest of six boys. And so there's this sort of beatnik hippie aesthetic, fierce individualism. I did my thesis on Kerouac and the Beats. So it didn't dawn on me until the last 5 years or so of my life is just how utterly dependent we are on other humans, and that maybe these Western myths of individualism, while lovely and poetic in some regard, might have also done us a disservice in our lack of connection to each other in the current culture.
I think individualism, I think of it as this force that's continually ripping us apart from one another, and really we need to be brought back together and connected to one another. And so it even starts with the way that we think about happiness as a concept. If you think about how to be happy, it's only about your happiness. You never talk about other people's happiness or their well-being or what's you're getting from them, how they're contributing to your life in any way. And we know from the research that our connections are the single greatest source of well-being in our lives. But what we don't recognize is the way that our society is not only structured to pull us apart from one another in all these ways and to disconnect us in a million little ways throughout the course of our day, our week, our lives, but also how we are wrapped up in that myth and that idea for ourselves. We go out there and pursue happiness for ourselves, never thinking about all of the opportunities that we have to contribute to other people's lives. And that's why ultimately I've come to believe that the secret to happiness is helping other people to be happy, because that's what brings you back together with them.
Yeah, Nick Epley at the University of Chicago, who's one of the scientists that we work with, one ca casually said this to Anne and I one day, which is, hey, if you're in a bad mood, go do something nice for someone else.
The truth. It's the most reliable way to change your day. And to be honest, I know that what I've witnessed is that sometimes people don't really want to hear that the secret to happiness is helping other people, because it feels, in an individualistic world, it feels so counterproductive towards your own goals and the things that you're striving towards. And that's why we have to help people to see that ultimately, the very best way to fulfill your own self-interest is to go out and help somebody else with their interests and their well-being.
So we're going to talk more about the new happy, but I think we probably should spend a little time identifying the old happy, because
Yes.
there would be no new happy without old happy, of course. Yin and yang, there's always the duality. So what is the old happy?
Old happy is society's definition of happiness and the culture that springs up surrounding it and the institutions that enforce it. And it is shaped by three forces of individualism, capitalism, and domination. They teach us what to value, how to think about ourselves, what we should do with our lives, how we should engage with the world and the people who live in it. And ultimately, it ends up creating this worldview within us of who we need to be in order to be happy. And that was what led me to my bedroom floor crying in to take us back to the beginning.
There's this common theme in this podcast, and I swear it is. I think it came up in my last podcast. It's going to come up in this one, and it's going to come in my next one, which is the enemy of this podcast is Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, who is one of the architects of this idea, not just about trickle-down economics, which is not a real thing, but it is. He represents this idea that
Oh
everyone's going to be generous and everyone's just going to take care of each other and they're not going to be
my God.
self-interested. And you talk about the idea that the old happy puts us on autopilot. And we know from our work in this area that the heuristics, of course, are a level of autopilot, and they're ingrained in us. And so, but there's other things that are ingrained in us, which is, as you mentioned, this need to connect, the need to do things for other people, in part too, because that's how we survive. Yeah. We literally can't survive with other people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, right? Because we have both of these impulses within us, right? As you said, we have this beautiful, generous, good nature within us. And that's who I believe we really are deep down. And then we have the social self or the societal self or the old happy self that has been conditioned into these ideas and then participates in systems and institutions that compel you to exacerbate them in many ways, right? Like if we live in a country that has no social safety net, then it is in your self-interest to seek out as much as you can for yourself, because in the event of the worst case scenario happening to you, nobody will be there for you. Nobody will be there to support you. You won't have any sort of system that you can lean on. And ultimately, then we know that that impacts creativity, the ability to do innovative things, the ability to start companies and to make beautiful things happen in the world. But we have all of these systems that essentially bring out our old happy beliefs and then make them even worse. And a lot of the time we don't even know that we're perpetuating them. We think that we're doing things in the right way, but actually we're contributing to this set of beliefs and systems around us.
We just interviewed Jessica Calarco for the podcast, who has this wonderful quote in her book. It's wonderful, it's beautiful, it's sad, which is that the world has a social safety net and the United States of America has women.
Oof. Hits.
Yes. Everyone take a beat, take a breath. And I don't know about your experience, but my experience is with the people who are doing this good work of trying to get that change. These are happy warriors.
Yeah.
They are not sad people. They laugh easily. They are kind. They break bread. They do all those things. And I don't think that's the picture that's been fed to us culturally.
No, totally. No. We have this idea that, you know, do-gooders, they are miserable, they're unhappy, they're stressed, they're struggling, they're mean or cynical. But there is a powerful path to being a very happy person who is consistently creating and doing good in the world. And I think that the more that we can elevate those people and show that your happiness and the happiness of other people, they are not at odds. That's the core problem with this individualistic society. It's like, it's me or you. In fact, it's me and you. We can do both at the same time. And to me, that's been the most illuminating and enlightening realization I've ever had, because it opens up this world of possibilities that were, you know, heretofore closed to me as potentials for well-being and creating and spreading good in the world. And so I often remind myself of it's me and you, and we can do this together and experience happiness, both of us and the world at the same time.
You do some myth busting in the book, and one of those is around how the world encountered Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Mm. Can you tell, that's a fun story. So I do, can you tell that story and then also tell us what might've been missing in that equation?
Yeah. So Maslow's pyramid, I'm sure we all know it, but just in case you have missed it somehow, it's a pyramid which argues that there are five core sets of human needs. At the bottom are your physical safety needs. And then you work your way up all the way to the tip top, which is self-actualization. And the idea being that you have to climb up the pyramid in order to fulfill all of your needs. But Maslow never made that. It was made by a bunch of management consultants who were trying to distill some of his ideas into a framework, because we love frameworks. They help us to take a hold on things. But unfortunately, what that does has perpetuated a lot of these ideas, like, oh, I have to do all of these things for myself in order to get to the top and be able to pursue a purpose or become all I can be, fulfill my potential, all of that stuff. But simultaneously, what they didn't attend for in this diagram was that Maslow later identified that we also have a need to self-transcend, to go beyond ourselves. And that ignorance, that fact that it's left off, has contributed to this idea of like, oh, I just have to do everything for myself. I'm going to satisfy all of my needs. And maybe then I'll help people. Maybe then I'll go out and do good in the world. But in fact, it's a need that's core to everything that you want to experience in your life. And simultaneously, the only reason that any of your needs are fulfilled is because somebody else is fulfilling their need to go beyond themselves. They're helping you to do that. You know, we don't we don't do anything for ourselves, essentially. We are constantly reliant upon other people. And so it's this opportunity to, I think, reframe this pyramid of needs into something that's more holistic and encompassing of what human beings really want and what fulfills them.
I feel lucky in the sense, which is before I maybe knew this stuff intellectually, it was so ingrained in me in the philosophies of improvisation, because in improv, if you've got a scene partner on stage, your only job is to save each other.
That's so beautiful.
And that just, that's an orientation that is, when you know that that's the case, it's in many ways, it's why you can do anything. Because you're just like, oh,
yeah.
I'm completely not in this alone. And the other thing that we, the term gifts get used a lot. So you any suggestion that you get from the audience, even if you think it's lousy, if you see it as a gift, you have an opportunity to potentially, again, we'll say transform, but it's very similar to transcend. And then we also have a phrase, which is you need to see all obstacles as gifts. And certainly in your situation, and we should talk a bit about that in terms of your partner and my situation, which my audience well knows with losing Nora, which is, you know, you'd be hard pressed. I think some people would say, how could that be a gift? But for me, there's a level of awakening that came out of a tragedy that I just don't know that I, in many ways, I am a happier person now than I was before. And that doesn't mitigate the tragedy.
Of
it doesn't
course.
Mitigate the grief or the trauma or any of that. But it's just true for me. And so I suspect, I mean, it seems that's what you say on the page as well.
It is. I think, so as I was doing this work to figure out how to redefine happiness, my partner suddenly became very ill out of nowhere. And it ultimately ended up creating all of these very, very difficult challenges in our lives, including great, great suffering on his part. And I became a caregiver out of nowhere and navigating all of the complexities of those experiences and the pain and the suffering. And I think what strikes me so much about what you're saying, Kelly, is I think part of it comes from this idea that happiness and sadness are opposites. Like, in order to have a happy life, you have to eliminate those pains. But of course, that's not possible. Of course, we can never do that. We desperately try to escape our humanity. And the more that we do that, the more pain that we create for ourselves, paradoxically. And to your point, like, the love that you have for people will always be laced with some form of pain or loss at the end of the day, right? There's always these difficulties, these challenges that we must face. And the tragedy that you went through, the fact that you can look at that and say, like, I am able to take something from this while I would do anything to make sure it would never happen and to go back in time. That's what living a truly happy life is about to me. It's about saying, here is the reality of my life and what can I do about it? And how do I make space for the pain that's a part of this, as well as the joy and the learning and the potential and the connection and the opportunities that I might have to move forward while never forgetting what I'm leaving behind. It's coming with me at the same time.
We were talking about Scott Barry Kaufman earlier, and of course his last book was called one of his last books was called Transcend, which was all about this Maslow stuff. But in one of his books called Choose Growth, he introduced, and I've used this quote so many times in my speaking dates, but it's by the cognitive scientist Irving Yalom, and he says, sooner or later you have to give up the hope for a better past.
There's another one that hits you right in there, isn't it? Like, And how long do you want to wait? Like, you know what I mean? Like, and of course you have to, as you said, you go through the grieving process and you go through the pain and you lean on people to help you process it and support it. And that's what I think ultimately, I think in my experience, I'm curious to hear for you, but that's what helps you to then move forward, right?
1,000%. And then if you objectively stand back, you're like, well, why do we go to sad movies? Why would you intentionally do that? Why would the book The Giving Tree exist, which, you know, it's like trauma inducing to children? And it's like, oh, because the elders knew, they knew that we needed to feel these experiences. We need to model these experiences because they will happen. And by the way, they're happen to all of us.
Yeah.
I had a keynote this earlier this week in New York City, and it was for this Future of Work conference. And I'm doing my thing, and it's really going over quite well with this audience. And so I'm like, I think I can be a little more truthful. And I was like, and I said to this group, this is like a corporate conference, but I'm like, anyone notice that we're all traumatized and we all have incredible grief and then we're not allowed to talk about it at work, which is the one place we need to talk about it because that's where we are the most of the time. And people are like hooting and hollering, and I'm just like, yeah. So let's realize that all exists in the room for a second, and maybe that'll allow us to have more curiosity, more humility, all the things we need to do to navigate what is an increasingly noisy world. It's noisy.
Yeah. And it's so easy to distract yourself from it, right? To your point, like, oh, there's always another meeting to rush to. There's always something that you have to do, an urgent deliverable. Who has the quote, like, who has the time to think about their pains and their traumas? Well, it's going to hit you if you don't. It's going to find a way in. And I think I love that you called that out, because especially thinking about the last few years, I feel like we just papered over the trauma of the pandemic, and we've just decided, oh, we're just going to memory hole that now, and we're never going to talk about it again. And there are people who are dealing with the consequences of that every day, and we should talk about it. We should make space for it.
Yes, completely. So this conference that I was at, it was the hotel was right next to the 9/11 memorial, and I hadn't been. I've been to New York plenty of times, but I hadn't gone down there.
Yeah.
And I didn't really, I thought the conference was in Midtown. So then when I got there, I'm like, and I walked over, and it's very moving.
I've heard. Yeah, I haven't been either.
It's really moving. And it was a beautiful day, and it was packed. And it was packed with people, more people were speaking other languages than English, than they were English. There were people with hijab. There were little kids, there were families, there was tour groups, there was high school groups, there were people crying, there were people laughing. And I'm sitting here, and you know what there wasn't anyone causing a problem.
Yeah.
There wasn't anyone feeling necessarily unconnected or it was like, oh my God, we forget that in particular social media, these algorithms reward the outrage, but when you step out into the actual world, it's not like that.
No, it's really not, is it? It gives me goosebumps to hear you say that, because it's like, I find that so beautiful, because here those people are showing up at this memorial and they have a sense of connectedness to one another. And that feeling is what we're all searching for, isn't it? That feeling that we're not alone in this. And I often think about how no one can bear anything alone. And the fact is, we're continually asking people to bear things alone. And this reticence to talk about pain and suffering just makes everybody feel lonely. So if we can just open up and talk more about it, paradoxically, we'll end up becoming happier as a people.
Yeah. I often think too, I mean, I don't know, you don't necessarily write about it in the book, and you know, John Haidt's book that's out right now, which talks about the sort of dangerous effects of social media, and I obviously am concerned about that. He also has wonderful work on the idea that we don't allow our kids to play enough. I really find that.
Yeah.
But there's another aspect of the research that I think misses one point, which is, in a very good pro-social way, we have told young people for the last dozen years or so that it's okay to share their mental health struggles. And I fear that now that they finally feel comfortable doing that, we're saying, oh, there's a crisis.
Yeah, I do too. I feel the exact same way. Oh,
maybe there's
that. No.
No. Oversharing.
We didn't want that.
So it's also like, well, maybe they're just telling the truth, because when I look back, I love my parents. My parents were so great. Did they both have incredibly traumatic childhoods that they didn't talk about and I didn't learn about until I was like in my late 20s? Yes.
Yeah.
It was like, and then what did that get passed on to me? So I don't know.
I feel the same. I think there's a worthy conversation to be had about social media and how it affects young people's well-being specifically. I think we need to broaden that aperture and think more broadly about adults as well. But I also think that to me, the social media is a symptom of the bigger problems, which are the problems with these worldviews that we've adopted. So, for example, as you said, if we lived in a fully pro-social world that was accepting of people, that treated all feelings as okay, and that encouraged each person to be true to who they are, you wouldn't necessarily log on to social media and compare yourself to other people all the time because you wouldn't be
No.
deriving your self-esteem from that. And so it's a symptom of how we approach the world, and it's in this little container and it's like an experiment or like mold or something growing in a tray, and it just keeps getting worse and worse. But really, we have to start with the bacteria, the problem that actually kickstarted this, which is how we see ourselves and how we see others and what we're striving for as human beings. Because if we don't do that, then everything is just going to be a band-aid solution, in my opinion.
One of my favorite things that you talk about is the Kurt Vonnegut story. And I was really lucky. So my first year of college, I went to Ithaca College for a year. I transferred then to Lake Forest College. But that first year, I audited a few classes at Cornell, and one of them was Kurt Vonnegut's class.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
So I sat in the very back, just like geeking out on Vonnegut coming in,
Was it
telling
like?
stories. Oh, it was amazing. I mean, very quirky teacher. I mean, half the time it was just him sort of telling stories, and then taking questions. But it was he was such a genius, that it was kind of magic. Can you tell the story about what happened with the school kids? I think it was high school kids.
Oh, I was so excited when I found this. So basically, there was a teacher in New York City. She was teaching at a school, not a privileged prep school or anything, a public school. And she set her kids an assignment to write to famous authors and ask them to come and visit the school. And so they divided up into little groups, and they all wrote letters to different authors. And then Kurt was the only one who responded.
Wow.
And he ended up calling the teacher and saying, I'm struggling with my health. It's going to be too difficult for me to come visit the kids, but I really appreciate it. Really made my day. And he ended up sending them this letter back where he talks about his best creative advice for them. And he essentially said his guidance was to go out and write a poem just for yourself and don't show it to anybody. When you're done, you can tear it up into little pieces. And I think he says, scatter it in different receptacles, which I love. And, then says, you don't have to show it to anyone. The whole point is that it will make your soul grow. Creating is what helps you to become more of yourself. And I found that story, and I was able to track down the teacher and some of the students who were in the classroom at the time. And what I felt was so beautiful, aside from the poetry and the gorgeousness of his advice in and of itself, was how that advice has lingered with these people who were in that room for their entire lives and has guided them in so many ways. And I view it as a really beautiful illustration of how sometimes we do things and we think they don't matter, but it all matters in ways that you might never see or understand.
Yeah, I mean that's such at the heart of Yes And. And I don't know if we discussed this way back. We probably did, but it was when we started doing the work at University of Chicago and Richard Thaler, the Nobel Prize winner, who was heading up the department of the project we were working on. He saw us lead this Yes And exercise, and he's like, "Wait, that's a nudge. I mean, behavioral economics shows us that people's default position is to say no or do nothing. And yes and is a nudge to just try it. And then in a very, again, pro-social way, try it, throw it in the world, have someone affirm it and come back and then affirm what they're saying and so forth and what you can build from that. And the reason we teach it in early classes here and almost in all the corporate environments is because people do the opposite. People tend to either say no or don't. And I know this for myself. It's like,
Me too.
it's easier just to stay home and watch a show on Netflix.
No thanks.
So thank you. I'm out. But then, yeah, how many times when you actually do go do the thing, do you end up, you don't regret it?
100% of the time you feel better. Like, it's a
Yeah.
no-brainer.
I said the story. I was talking to Renee Fleming, who's an old pal for the Chicago Humanities Festival, and I told her the story. I think I shared it on here too, where I had tickets for to see Roseanne Cash,
at the Old Town School Folk Music, a tiny venue walking distance from my home. And my wife Anne was like, I don't think I'm up for it tonight. And I'm like, I think this is going to be special. Let's just do it. Yeah. And we did it. And by the time we turned to the encore, I turned to look at Anne and she's sobbing.
Oh.
In the most beautiful way. She's like, it hit me. Everything came back to me. My parents sitting around a campfire in Grand Forks, North Dakota, singing these civil rights songs. And it was 500 miles they were playing. And I'm just like, you would not have had that moment. And it was a stupendous concert. And so that's part of this is sort of opening yourself up to experiences in the world and people. And again, there was tears, but it was joyful.
It's so interesting because, I mean, yes, and connects so much to everything that I share in my book in so many ways. I see it like it's like a sibling in so many ways to these ideas. Yeah. Because as you're saying, it's like if happiness comes from connection and from looking for opportunities to contribute to those connections, then we have to be open. It's like a precursor in order to be able to take advantage of it. We have to be open and say, I'm not this closed off ego that's separate from other people. I'm open to being influenced by them. And that to me is so much in so many ways what Yes And is all about. It's saying I refuse to close down and I remain open even when it's uncomfortable, even when it's hard, because I know that's what's best for me and for the greater good.
I should say to listeners, so this book is organized in a couple different ways. You have your story, but it's sort of equal parts pointing us at the science, and good rigorous science. This is not like pop science. And then also just amazing stories. And I'd love you, before I ask you for your Yes And story, which I'm going to do in a moment, can you tell this amazing story of Samuel Alinor? Tell us about that.
So Samuel Alinor was a, I believe, 9-year-old Jewish boy living during World War II. And he was pulled into the Boboa ghetto and with his whole family. And his stepmother encouraged him to run away and hide one day when they were having roundups. And he climbed up onto a roof. And it was from that roof that he watched his entire family get slaughtered. And he managed to escape the camp when they weren't looking. And he ran several miles. And he ended up coming to a farm that was owned by a woman and her family who his father had done trade with before the Nazis had taken over. And he knocked on the door and didn't know if she would report him or take him in. And her name was Balvina. And she took him in and sheltered him. She taught him the Polish catechism. She taught him she gave him a new name. She helped him figure out how to survive. And eventually she got him a job at a neighboring farm where nobody from their town would recognize them. And she even did things like sending her son, who was a similar age, over to visit him to pretend that they were friends so that it would make his story more plausible. So Samuel survived World War II, and he eventually immigrated to the United States, to California, where he decided to devote his life to studying people like Balvina, who take great risks to protect other people and to understand what it is that separates them from those who do not. And he ended up teaming up with his wife, who was a fellow scientist, and they devoted their entire lives until they were in their 90s to trying to understand these things that separate these people who are passionate about doing good for others.
I mean, that must have been, I can only imagine you discovering that.
Oh, yeah.
In a horror book and being like, sobbing. Yep, all right, yes, to sobbing.
Oh, my God. Whenever that's the joy of creating, isn't it? When you are pulling from these influences, and I found it, and it wasn't even a light bulb moment. It was like a lightning moment hitting me and saying, okay, this is it. Because what they discovered is that the people who do good, who help others, even in the most dangerous of circumstances, they don't see themselves as separate from others. They see themselves as inextricably connected. You are me and I am you, and I have no choice but to help you. It's not even something that they consider. And ultimately, this is that the biggest and the most important shift I think we can make. It's the recognition that we are deeply connected to one another. And therefore, if I see Kelly, you as an extension of me, I want to invest in your well-being because you are a part of me and vice versa. And that's how we can be there and care for one another.
I want to see if I brought this book with me that I'm reading right now, because you just made me think of this.
I'm so excited.
So I am reading this book by Kelly Clancy called Playing with Reality, How Games Have Shaped Our World. Mm. So it is a history of games like chess, war games, game theory, all that. And she talks about play in ways that I think connect to our conversation. Mm. One of the things that I just pulled a quote because I just did my notes. And the quote is, quote, play uncouples behavior from rote instinct, facilitating flexibility. It draws chance into the realm of experience. It's a safe platform to test the unknown.
Mm. That's beautiful. Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Giving people the space to move into a new becoming of themselves or of the world through play.
It is the seriousness of play, right? It's the essentialness. And what she says, one of her critiques, she has lots of critiques about behavioral science, which is very interesting, in part because she believes what they call biases, and maybe that's a term that has taken on a negative connotation when it shouldn't, are just simply the way that people think. Mm. And what we know from our work at Second City is giving people embodied experiential chances to just try it a different way is immensely gratifying to these people because it is dense in surprise.
Mm. It's so, I mean, I'm constantly amazed at this in myself. Like, I know this. I know that I'm capable of change. I know that I can be surprised. I know that I have the ability to go beyond what I think, but I still find it so surprising how often I get stuck, how often I just do the same thing over and over again, or get caught in the same patterns. And all it takes is, as you're saying, is one different experience to remind you of what's possible.
Yeah. I did an informational interview this morning with a kid graduated college, once again, in the entertainment industry. This is not an uncommon thing for people I try to always say yes. And increasingly, you know, my advice is, you know, get into a room, get into the room that you want to be in, even if you're there just to serve coffee. Mm-hmm. But then I go, and then remember what you were taught in kindergarten and focus on that. You know, this deliberate play, being kind, listening, sharing stories, all the things that somehow we don't keep up with in our education, which then when you get into this real world that you and I live in, are the bedrock of our ability to flourish or not.
It's so true. Like, sometimes people say about my work, like, oh, that's really simple, or that's basic, or that's understandable. And I'm like, okay, show me how you're putting it into practice. Cause it's way harder. Like, it is harder to be a good listener than it is to be distracted on your phone. It is harder to be patient when you want to go do something for yourself. It is harder to be generous when you're desiring a specific want or something like that, you know? And it's hard to play in a world that doesn't want you to play and doesn't have the system set up for it. And I think that it's that embrace of those things that were taught in kindergarten, as you said, they then get taught out of us by the world, and it's up to us to bring them back.
And I truly cannot think of any great thing in my life that was not achieved through something incredibly hard.
Oh, I agree.
Right?
How annoying.
And that sucks.
it's like one of those things where I'm like, damn, there are no shortcuts. Proven time and again.
There are no shortcuts. They're not. No. And you can take a shortcut, and you are you're going to be shortening your own everything. The shortcut will reveal itself to make the thing that you're in less special, you know, less important, less purposeful, less meaning. Okay, we always ask our guest at the end of the podcast to tell us a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yeah, of course. it's actually the beginning of my entire journey. So when I was thinking about this prompt, I realized that it's such a testimony to the work that you do, because it's how I ended up in this chair talking to you today. So
When I graduated from my graduate program, I had no idea what I was going to do with the knowledge that I had developed. And I had just written this big thesis. It was like 160 pages, hundreds of references arguing that, you know, we needed a new approach to happiness. And I knew even then that no one was going to really want to read it because it was boring and dense and academic and all that. And so I had this thing on my computer and I had no idea what to do with it. And I felt very dispirited and hopeless about it because, you know, you do work on something, you want to share it with people. And people kept saying to me like, oh, why don't you try and switch jobs or try and do this or become a coach or go and do that? And all of them, I just was like, no, I'm not really interested in that. And it's not doing what I really want to do. So I kept dismissing all of these possibilities that likely would have helped me to figure out how to actualize it in some way. But I kept saying no. And then my partner one day said to me like, why don't you just start a newsletter or start writing about it? Even if you just do it, you know, a little bit at a time, why don't you just do it? And I thought, okay, yes, I'll do that. And I want it to be even more than that. I want it to be a community of people who are excited about these ideas and living in this way. And then all of a sudden, all of these ideas started pouring out of me, like, and I want it to be something that one day helps people to realize that they can help people and coming up with all of these different approaches. And that little shift is what made everything else in my life possible from that moment forward. It's what opened up my whole career. I guess this is what I do now. So to me, that powerful moment of saying yes and is what unlocked all of the things that I wanted in life for myself and for others.
You know, and the other thing that reminds us is that it was a tiny step.
Yeah. So you know, tiny.
It was a little bet.
And
those are the things that you do to then make the big changes. These brains of ours take is like, oh, if I'm gonna like really find my life's calling, it's gonna be a grand reveal. There will be lightning and orchestras playing, and it's like, no, it might be as simply, you know, as picking up the phone.
So true. I could not agree with that more. Like it was just the act of sending the first email that opened up everything for me. And that email went to, I think, 17 people. Like, it was not changing the world. It was not doing anything on any scale, but it changed my world. And then that's what made everything else possible.
The book is called New Happy, Getting Happiness Right in a World That's Got It Wrong. Stephanie Harrison, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you. So grateful to be here with you.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
most of your life from adulthood. No one survived.